Oh, fair enough. Well, yeah, ignore me then. Let's just crack on.
Okay, hi everybody. Welcome back to Cider Voice. This is part two of our food love episodes. Hopefully you've all tuned in to part one where we talked about random pairings on the fly with what we were drinking. We talked about, well, Ben gave us a great rundown of kind of an intro to making a pairing. We talked about our favorite food memories. We talked about building food cultures. The theme of today's episode is the best possible imagined, no restrictions, the impossible is possible, cider and Perry banquet to end the universe. At the end of the universe, it's all about to disappear into a tiny blip, and there's one four-course dinner left. And my wonderful guests of Adam, Justin, and Ben are going to describe, they're going to pitch their meals. It's like Great British Menu, except it's Great End of the Universe Banquet, and each of my chefs is presenting a different course, but only one will be taken through to serve to the guests at the end.
I mean, that is an appallingly high bar to clear.
Yeah.
Wow. Unless I'm like the fucking sirloin of God.
We've chopped him up. Universe.
I have another 4 hours.
And instead of attack and dethrone God, attack and debone and then eat God.
Okay, so the stakes are very high. That's the banquet. The banquet is the end of the universe. As our kind of my question to ease you all into this, if this was the end of the universe banquet that you were cooking for, which one person from the entirety of human history, or animal, I suppose you could have an animal, if you're like mega into like the Diplodocus and you were like, they should be at the end of the universe, that'd be fine. But you've got each got one guest that you can invite.
Oh my God.
Ben looks furious. Justin's like, it's too much. I love history too much.
I should probably say that if I'm only allowed to invite one guest to the banquet at the end of the universe, then yeah, it would be my wife, right. Caroline.
Oh, literally, I'll
just pick Ray, won't I?
Immediate partners, no. It has to be some kind of ludicrous.
All right. It has to be a historical or famous person to whom we're not affiliated.
Yes.
There's going to be a lot of thinking time that you're going to have to cut out when you edit.
No, that's going to be so aggressively edited that there will be no thinking time, and the start and finish of every sentence will be slightly clipped.
Everyone will go, wow, these people are so witty and quick.
I know.
I'll betray my ancient history degree roots here and say, if I get the opportunity to have one person from history at my dinner at the end of the universe, and this is for pretty shit reasons, really, but I'm going to pick Polybius and be like, buddy, what's in the rest of the fucking books? Because we don't have all of his books. And throughout my degree, there were so many times where I'd be reading his books and be like, what the fuck happens in the next book? I need that. So, Polybius. And I want
to know.
For people
who have no idea who Polybius or his books are, please tell me more.
Polybius is like a Greek person who ends up living with the Romans and writes basically this very, very long book, which pretty much was like my dissertation. I just sort of wrote the same story, but it's about how Rome becomes the preeminent power in the Mediterranean. So there are wars with Carthage and in Spain and with the Greeks, and I think later on as well. But we only have fragments of his entire bibliography, essentially. So he is a good historian, unlike many of the writers at the time. So he is relatively reliable, and we know lots and lots of things about the ancient world because of Polybius. But due to a number of disasters, and I believe the burning of the Alexandria Library is one of them, many of his texts were lost, except a number of them. So we actually have a pretty substantial amount. There's a good, you know, novel's right, yeah, worth, paperback novel's worth, but we are missing quite a few of them, as is the case with a lot of ancient historians.
It's important to note as well that unlike a lot of other
how important is it, Justin?
It is important. It is fucking important, all right? And it'll take 5 seconds. As opposed to a lot of our other Roman historians, Polybius was an eyewitness to a number of the events. So he was actually eyewitness to Scipio's campaigns in the Third Punic War, I think. Rather than being like fucking Plutarch, who's like, 500 years ago, this stuff definitely happened.
Exactly, yeah, and that is the
Albert,
problem.
Albert is currently like, oh, you know what would be a great idea? Getting people to pitch their one person.
Okay, Adam, who's your person?
I've been giving it some thought, and I think that there's a whole bunch of people from ancient history who might be quite interesting, but would I want to sit with them for a full meal? Or would they turn out to mainly be awful people, or, you know, or not interesting, or they don't speak the same language as me, or they're not that bothered by food? But I would quite like to spend a meal with Terry Pratchett, the novelist, because he was just, I think he's brilliantly witty. He was apocryphally very good to chat to if you were just a, you know, a regular person who went up and had a word. His food and drink all the way through his book, so I suspect that he would be interested in that, but he's not a food or drink snob. So I would have a very good time appreciating Terry Pratchett's wit and wisdom over a food and cider pairing that I thought was interesting and that I don't think he would say derogatory things about.
I like that. I like that a lot. Justin?
I ended up getting kind of fixated on the end of the universe thing and was thinking that I'd like to bring someone who I really want to instill utter existential dread in. So like a real piece of shit that I can make them look at the end of the universe and be like, this is it, motherfucker, this is it.
Yes, but they are getting the greatest meal that they'll
ever
do.
Yeah, that's the issue. So maybe someone like that, but who was famously ascetic, and so I could eat their food and they would just feel dread. Can't think of anyone off the top of my head.
I've painted myself into a corner.
Yeah, exactly. Never has that happened before. Otherwise, I don't know. Somebody loud and braying, probably, so that we could both be loud and braying together.
I accept.
Ben. I'll invite Ben. Because I also want to see him face ultimate annihilation.
I think that it would be appropriate for the last banquet of the universe to invite Leonardo da Vinci.
Oh, so that's pretty spicy.
He can be there for his painting.
Oh, that's pretty spicy. That's a good.
Another good person, actually. I've picked Terry Pratchett, but you could say literally because he wrote a thing called The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, which is literally about this bit, to have Doug Adams. The writer of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Because you could be like, well, is this panning out as you wrote in the book? Is a creature coming up to you and asking which bit of it you'd like to eat? No, you're just having nice cider and peri. It's much boringer.
Actually, to be a real dickhead, maybe the first person who ever successfully and reproducibly produced cider. So I could be like, here we are at the very end, and this is what your drink will become.
Mm-hmm. And he'd be like, and here's what my drink is. And he'd taste it and it'd be acetic and rancid.
Some Neolithic, you know, caveman type person from Western Europe or whatever being like, I might be historically bullshit to be honest, but just being like, what is this nonsense bottle? What is this vessel you've given me? All of course.
What if... don't we cupping it up with your hands?
Wouldn't it be funny if instead, as it turned out, like the greatest cider ever made happened to be the very, very first pressing? So they absolutely nailed it and it's unimprovable. And the thousands of years of cider history since has just been like an attempt to get close to that first pressing.
Some Celt has brought along a clay bottle with some liquid in it and you try it and you're like, oh, fuck off.
Yeah. There's no point in doing anything. God damn it. I thought that it was all right. In the old days, people were wrong, but they were right about cider. Fuck. Sorry, Albert. Sorry, okay. We'll let you get on with the episode now, Albert.
Before we move on to food, it's the banquet at the end of time. Very quickly, can you describe the glass that you would like each... your cider and peri to be served in? Is it different glasses? Is it the same glass for every course? Is it even made of glass? Maybe it's like titanium.
Or a horn.
Oh, or a horn. The sound, the end of the world.
Have different and unbelievably obnoxious stemware for every single... That didn't even necessarily have any bearing on the contents of the glass. They were just increasingly elaborate, absurd, and like maddeningly fragile.
You need a gigantic table Even though there's only two people eating, you need a table that's sort of one of those gigantic comedy long banquet tables to fit in the four glasses each. So large is their bowl. And each of them gets like a shot poured into. No, I would have one. I would keep it simple. I would have I might have a fresh glass for each course, but I would simply think for this banquet. Yeah, I know. Well, just so you're not being contaminated by what was in it beforehand. You know, I'm not a monster. I would have just a fairly simple, straightforward, nice wine glass. Nothing too fancy. I just think that kind of does all styles pretty well, I'd say.
I'm a big fan of a stemless glass, I think. Stemless glass.
I think this is the great debate of our age, actually.
Well, the thing is that the great debate implies that, you know, there's good arguments on both sides. No, stemless glass is a good thing.
We've had both, for Ross and my, stemless, kind of the kind of mainstream glass that's been adopted by everybody with the slightly curved angled sides. And we had teku glasses with the stem. And I have to say that the teku glasses, when I go back to use one of my precious, I have like 8 left. I'm like, this is drinking now.
They were amazing, and mine got broken by persons who will remain nameless. No, I don't have a Ross Teku glass.
Someone is looking very sheepish on this.
No, it wasn't Justin, it was Caroline. But Justin has broken several of my glasses for sure, yeah. But the Ross Teku, I cannot let it
speak. They've all been Glencairns that I've broken.
Can I offer one thing as a hospitality worker or a bartender that I say to everyone who ever breaks a glass in our bar is glasses get broken, and it happens. There'll be more glasses. Move on. It's fine.
But there won't be more Ross Cider Teku glasses because they're incredibly expensive.
I mean, that's life, isn't it?
The ferocity that you said glasses get broken with there, Ben, made me think that there was like going to be a really menacing suffix. Like somebody says, oh, I'm really sorry, I've smashed this glass. Glasses get broken. And so do noses.
Yeah.
I mean, that is very much the way I conduct myself in hospitality, is with a kind of menacing intensity. That
it's a miracle you're employed.
Doesn't befit my small 5'8" stature.
Excellent. Okay, right, so everybody, the guests are filtering in for the banquet. It's sensational. It's like there's no ceiling, right? It's just the universe slowly exploding above our heads. But people have to be brought back to reality by their welcome drink. So what's your end of the universe welcome drink?
Hold up. I didn't realize there was supposed to be a welcome drink.
Well, I can jump in quickly on this one. Welcome drink. Even though this is a funny one for me, because I think that the new C1 Foxwelp is the best C1 yet, and I think it's absolutely incredible. I think it's, you know, a almost perfect Foxwelp. But I would probably serve the 2020 C1 because that was the aperitif drink that I served at my wedding, and I still have a few bottles of it left, which are being very carefully nurtured and guarded. So I would definitely like a fresh supply of that to serve at the end of the universe.
Yeah, I can see that really being very nice. Foxwelp, obviously, that for the plug, Foxwelp's going to be what we use for our welcome drink at our supper club. And a perfect palate cleanser, perfect refresher.
Justin, do you have an aperitif that you would serve?
Yes, actually. I think it's okay to begin as an aperitif to have a fortified.
Yeah, do what you want. Yeah.
Mate, it's literally the end of the universe.
Well, I'm still a coward in the face of public opinion. I would be tempted to start with a Mostello, actually. So Adam introduced me. We were joking about his on my holidays about Mosfeardle last time, but it's fascinating. Region, and he brought back a couple of bottles of Mostello, which is a fortified perry, I believe. And I think, I don't know whether I'll be able to choose between the dry or the sweet, but I feel like that is a fascinating and engaging drink that kind of, to me, sort of switches my palate on. Maybe start with the dry one so it didn't cloy up your palate beforehand. Not that the sweet one is cloying, but you know, sweetness sometimes feels like it sticks around a little longer.
It's interesting. They're very and I mean, we'll come back to my main course pairing later. But yeah, they're very rich drinks because there's only one. You know, it's not really a category. It's something that this one perry maker, the distiller I fart offer, has come up with. And yeah, it's fortified perry, but they age them for 4 years in barrel and then a few more years in bottle. So they, you know, they're big, rich drinks. Yeah, I definitely think you're on the right lines with the dry for like a kickoff. But then like lots of dry sherries, you know, they've taken their lead from sherry for their dry, and lots of dry sherries are served as aperitifs. So that sounds really cool.
Oh, I'm glad I was on the right track, because I thought that was the case, but I wasn't sure. But I feel like that would be like a nice, like, kind of savory beginning, almost.
Yeah, no, I can see that. I really wanted to shoehorn what will become my welcoming drink into the four courses, and I really struggle with it because it didn't quite work in the ways that the other sizes I chose work. But I'm really happy that I've got an opportunity to serve it because it's one of my favorite sizes I've ever had. And it's Derrida by Eve Cidery over in America. And I think it kind of works in the same way as the C1 Foxwell, right? Like, it's got that acidity. It's got that lovely kind of like palate cleansing quality, but it also has a wonderful kind of like oranginess, if I recall, like tangerine-y kind of quality to it. And I think it's nice as well because every single cider I've written down for my dinner is from the United Kingdom. So it's nice to include someone else from around the world. and that Derrida is fantastic. I mean,
that's phenomenal.
Yeah. Drinking it with Albert, and we were trying. I was trying my best to write about it in note, and I think I was just kept being like, "Fuck, it's so good." And Albert was like, "Yeah, but it's really acidic. Get the Rennie." But you enjoyed it as well, didn't you, Albert?
Yeah, totally. No, that's a really high quality cider. No doubt about it.
And it has that acid. That acid, I think, is kind of crucial. You know, to go the opposite way to Justin, but like having the acid in the cider rather than the alcohol that you went for, Justin. I think they both have that.
Excellent. Well, what we're going to do is, everybody's suggestion will get put to the Cider Voice Twitter, and there will be a public vote where all 12 of you listeners will be able to select your preferred option. And then for the banquet, that's what we'll produce. That's our welcome drink. I'm going to ask each of you in turn to introduce your starter. I just want to check, has anybody themed their banquet around anything, or are we just a free-for-all? Because Ben, like you mentioned, all your ciders are from the UK, so.
Well, my theme is shit I like to eat.
I haven't heard of that kind of theme before. Did you get any inspiration for that from anywhere in particular, or just kind of?
No, so very specifically, there is my favourite dessert of all time. A dish for the main, I've actually already mentioned on the previous episode, that I cooked. And then the first time I ever put together a decent pairing, that other people said this is actually quite good. So that's on there. And then obviously there's a cheese course at the end, which is just some of my favourite cheeses. But it is very much, yes, it probably is quite British centric in its construction, but not by design. It just happened to be that way.
Justin, Adam, any themes?
There isn't really a particular theme. Like, it's things that I like to eat, but I've kind of tried to put a bit of a like to
fine
eat in
dining.
If I'm at for most of it, but also like just going back to previous episodes, like things that have really struck me in the past, and that I've tried to work in. I will say that I've decided that for each course I've got a cider and a perry option, because I think that, you know, otherwise we might not have too many perries featuring, and it's always important to include perry in all of this. And we've got a perry banquet that we should mention that's coming up at the Hereford Applefest.
I mean, forgive really me if I'm wrong, but I think there might be something else perry related coming up, Adam.
yes, I have written the first draft of a book called Perry, A Drinker's Guide, and that does feature a discussion on food pairings, including a lot of the kind of invaluable tips that Ben gave, and leading with his opening gambit, which is that if, you know, you really just love this perry and you love this other food, then that's absolutely fine, and you don't necessarily need to follow any of these tips. But if you are interested in kind of considering how you might get, you know, the most enjoyment out of, you know, a Perry and the food you're having it with, then here are some things that I do.
Totally. And is that book going to be available when, or how do people find out more?
So, if all goes according to plan, it will be available from May the 9th next year. But in October, and I suppose by the kind of time gap of all podcasts, you're probably listening to this in October, dear listener. We have a Kickstarter. Same principle as was done for Modern British Cider, the excellent book that Gabe Cook wrote a couple of years ago now. So the idea is that it's kind of pre-sales and generating interest. So would really, really love if our 12 listeners would go to Canberra's website where, or you know, any of our various social media where they will see links to the Kickstarter and how they can get involved. But I'm just really excited because, you know, it's a proper drinker's guide to Perry, you know, and hopefully it's aimed at people at all levels because so little's been written about Perry, right? That, you know, however versed you are in Perry, hopefully there'll be some stuff in the book that will be new to you. But if you're just a casual drinker coming across it for the first time, hopefully, like, stuff like food pairing and flavours and stuff like that is all in there.
Yeah, so by extrapolation, it's also an excellent book to buy gifts for. So people should buy multiple copies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All of your friends and all of your family members, even if they live in the same house, will all need their own copy, I should think, because otherwise they're just going to be bickering over who gets to read it first. So the safe bet will be to buy multiple copies for your family members as well.
100%. Thank you.
100%.
Great. Yeah, and actually, on the topic of Perry, before we start, whilst we're on the subject of plugs, I'm drinking a brand new Perry from us that's made by a pair we've never used before that we bought last year that we couldn't identify that we've called Speckled Russet, which has just become available. And it's incredibly drinkable. It's just incredibly drinkable. It's very soft, very fruity, very juicy with kind of a hint of black pepper. I'm really liking it. It's going down super easy. So
that's really cool.
This could be a welcome drink at the end of the world. Just
are there any like existing Perry pairs or Perrys that it reminds you of?
It's kind of similar in flavor to kind of a little bit of a peppered version of Hendra Hufkamp. That's probably
cool.
The kind of orangey marmalade flavor of Hendra Hufkamp. That's the most similar, I think. Kind of the smooth acidity. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked. So, guys, I would like you now, we're going to talk about the starter for our End of the World Banquet. Ben, are you ready to go first?
Absolutely, yeah. My starter will come as no surprise to the four or five people in the world who've ever read any of my writing either. This is one of the first pairings that I ever came up with, and I'm quite proud of it. Now, a little bit of backstory. So in my family, and we are not a particularly wealthy family, but we do have some wealthy proclivities that we like to pretend, particularly around Christmas. And something that my mum and dad have all, you know, my mum in particular has always given us on Christmas Day is smoked salmon, often on a blini, often with cream cheese. And then we have that, you know, with Buck's Fizz in the morning. And I always thought it would be wonderful, and then tried this a few Christmases ago, to have the exact same thing. So smoked salmon with the blini and with the cream cheese, with a kind of champagne method cider. And the particular one I've chosen is one of my absolute favourites. And the individual who runs this cider is also an absolute sweetheart human. Tinston's Anatomy, which I believe, a little bit rusty because I've been out of the game a wee while, but it's an eating apple based cider, but it is then made in the champagne method, which I think is very similar to how they make a lot of their wine that they make. And you get this very, very kind of clean, fruity, crisp cider. The carbonation is absolutely wonderful. And I've actually tried this pairing, and it works so well together because you have that right kind of like rich and kind of almost a little sweet but smoky salmon, lots and lots of fat in there. Then you've got that cream cheese, and then you have that blini, which is, you know, a kind of almost fermented type of carbohydrate that you have it on. It's I can't remember exactly how you make it, but I think it's made very specific type of grain, you know, flour. And it all just works really well together. You get lots of that contrast, you get lots of that cutting, but then you do get some really nice complements between the fruitiness of the cider and the kind of sweetness that you get in that salmon. I recommend that everyone try it, particularly at Christmas, if you want to have a cidery Christmas. it's something that I think is very, very nice. And I also think would work in other ways. If you wanted to just have a pan-fried smoked salmon, you could also use that cider. It's quite, Adam will know more than I, but I think it's quite a popular thing, right, Adam, to have champagne with greasy shellfish and greasy fish, isn't it? It's quite,
the ultimate. I think the
famous pairing with champagne is just British fish and chips, isn't it?
Yeah, that is like ultimate wine industry. You know, the nicer the champagne you're opening, the greasier the fish and chips.
Yeah, and I think you can play that game with this very, very good cider. So yeah, that's my starter, and that is my opening cider.
I like it. I think it's a strong starter. I actually got super into smoked salmon last week because my godfather took my dad and I to the cricket, and he brought some smoked salmon sandwiches, which I never would choose for myself. And they were fantastic. So I'm actually quite excited about yours. And we had ours with our Fawn Flaky and Friends Perry, and it was lovely. Yeah. You know, the kind of...
I can see that being really nice.
Delicate flavours in the drink go really nicely with it. So, Justin, what is your challenge to the smoked salmon?
So I've been swithering about this one because I'm terribly indecisive, but I have settled on one. Swithering. I have settled on a caprese salad. So buffalo mozzarella, nice tomatoes, basil and olive oil with a lot of salt. And that's to go with a Kumadic gin pear peri. The reason being that I thought that the sort of aromatics of the gin pear with the just that little nibble of acid, little bit of very gentle tannins, but largely a kind of aromatic, kind of bright floral thing to go with a very aromatic, fresh salad.
Sounds fucking amazing.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not even a cheese person, and that sounds like a perfect combination.
I mean, to be honest, you could take out this. I mean, my lunch is regularly just tomatoes with olive oil and basil and salt. I don't even need the cheese to absolutely demolish a bowl of that. So just take out the cheese and you're fine.
Total risk of derailing this conversation.
when have we, whomst amongst us has ever derailed a conversation, Ben?
Until very recently, I didn't really like fresh tomatoes very much. Loved tomatoes cooked into things, but didn't really like fresh tomatoes. And the other day, probably about 2 months ago, for the first time in my life, I was like, I want to try more things. I want to try more flavors. I'm always banging on to people at work. You only get better at tasting beer by tasting more beers, and you only get better at tasting things by tasting more things. So I was like, bought a chicken club sandwich, and it was one of the greatest things I've ever eaten in my life. And then the other day, I bought a BLT, and I was like, I am the stupidest man alive. Well, what? Why have I not been eating this all my life? This is like the ultimate hangover food.
You're getting BLT pilled.
Honestly, God, I feel like a fraud of a human. Honestly,
I've had exactly the same experience with tomatoes. Is that I never ate fresh tomatoes when I was a kid, and then that translated to never buying them as an adult. But I went to visit friends in Toulouse last year and had tomatoes that they grew on their little farmstead, which had been grown in like the 40 degree heat that they endured all summer, and so there was no water content. It was like eating an apple. It was just incredibly intense tomato flesh. And it was so tasty that it totally opened my eyes to actually just eating tomato in the raw form, as you said, which I'd never done before. So I like the idea that if we serve either of your two dishes at the banquet at the end of the world, Adam will be forced to eat cheese. Which is not something that I will ever do to you in real life, Adam, but at the end of the world.
The banquet at the end of the world has the option for the non-dairy.
Yeah, of course it does. It's very inclusive. So, Adam, what is your non-dairy starter?
So, I have been slightly inspired here by a couple of things. Firstly, I didn't particularly, I liked food insofar that I ate food when I was growing up, but I wasn't particularly interested in food. And then, so I distinctly remember the first time that I went to a sort of, a smarter restaurant. I was at kind of university age, and I remember they had pigeon breast on the menu, and I kind of vaguely thought that I might be interested in game just because it's not the same three meats that you see everywhere. So I was like, oh yeah, I'll try that. And I just always remember like being like, oh my god, this tastes different than anything I've ever had before. This is incredible. I love this. Just that like depth and richness of it. Then also, having spent a large amount of time living up in Scotland, and it was always family holidays with our family and Justin's family, and then like later in my life I went and lived there. You know, I really love the food that you eat. When you kind of get out in the Highlands there. So I would have my pigeon breast, and I'd kind of take an earthy direction with it. So like a little base of just a bit of haggis with like pearl barley and kind of a root vegetable crisp kind of thing. So very like gamey, earthy, that sort of vibes. And so with Scotland still in my head, I would want that to pair that with something with acidity to cut through all that like earthiness and denseness and richness. But I would also like to have an element of smoke. So my cider option would be ideally a fox whelp with a bit of peat. And Little Pomona made an excellent one there. Their initial Solera fox whelp that I recently had for the first time in ages and thought was amazing. Tom Oliver has also made a fantastic peated fox whelp in the past. It was in his initial Out of the Barrel Room series. And I've been lucky enough to get a pre-taste of a very good peated fox whelp from a producer whose name escapes me at the moment. But it has, you know, it's furthered my conviction that peat and fox whelp are very good friends indeed. But my Perry option, thinking along the same lines of having that acidity, that minerality, but also that hint of smoke, would be the Thorn and Flaky Bark 2020 from yourself, Albert Ross and Y, which is unlike any other. I mean, you've done Thorn Flake in Friends a lot, and it tends to be a, you know, a juicy kind of full-bodied sort of thing, whereas this one was leaner in a good way. You know, it kind of had that skewer of thorn acidity, it had the minerality, it had smoke from being in a x-ray on Detra, and it was just, you know, one of the most evocative perries that I can ever remember trying. And so yeah, that would be my choice to go with my starter.
Yeah, awesome. I really like it. I like as well how it's a big contrast to the two kind of more refreshing dishes that were offered up. I mean, not that it wouldn't be a great starter, it definitely sounds like a fantastic starter, but I also think it's interesting that I asked if there was a theme to your banquet menu and you said no, but the theme has clearly become fox whelp because it was your welcome drink and your starter drink.
Well, yeah, that has ended up being the thing. I hadn't planned an aperitif thing, but when you've said, you know, what's your welcome drink, I can't not have it be that. And I'd already written the fox whelp down. That's the end of fox whelp from me for today. But yeah, like I will say that my meal is probably quite suitable for the end of the universe, because I really wouldn't want to deal with the food coma that it will put me in. Years afterwards.
Go on, Ben.
Well, I was going to say, in the spirit of something we mentioned off mic about vegetarians and vegans, and Justin adapted his for vegetarians and vegans, you can make a very, very nice version of my dish if you very finely slice carrots and then you marinate it in some really lovely things like soy sauce and some seaweed and some smoked paprika. Get all those kind of smoky, salty flavors going. Slow bake that in the oven to get it to literally like falling apart, like smoked salmon is, and then just fridge that. And a couple of Christmases ago, I made it for my partner because she doesn't eat a lot of meat and fish and things like that. And I'd say it's a pretty good attempt. I'm not really a big fan of remaking nice meat or fish dishes in a vegan way. I think it's really fun just to make nice dishes out of vegetables. Like, I don't necessarily like the idea of, like, I've made lasagna, and it, you know, I just think the idea, like, you know, these things taste amazing, let's just make them in a fun way. But that is a separate issue altogether. But yeah, so there is a vegetarian option, and it also goes very well with the Tintin anatomy. Sorry, just wanted to jump.
No. That's great. It's fine. All right, thank you, everybody. So we've got three really interesting starters. The guests are feeling kind of invigorated. It's that feeling when you've arrived for your supper club or your banquet. You don't really know, you know, are you going to like the food? Is it worth the money? Is it really living up to the end of the world experience? But actually, they've all been well impressed by what you've come up with. And now everyone is hungry, including our 12 listeners who are salivating at the thought of all this food to hear what the main course options are. So I think
I should just say before we do the main course that my four courses, I think, are probably a bit different than Justin and Ben's, because I don't have a cheese course. I have a fish / pasta course that goes before the main.
I have actually been a real knobhead and done something similar to Adam, except mine goes fish, main, cheese. So yeah, we're playing jazz with our courses.
It's cool. Look, we've all got four dishes-ish. So we'll just say the second course, not the main course. Isn't it this one? But although, isn't this one in Italy called the Primo?
I could get my book.
We don't have time.
We don't have time. All right, Albert, so Adam.
I think you're right, Albert. Isn't it? And obviously, one of the 12 listeners, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. Second course, first course starter, second course is like meat, and then the third course is a pasta course. So you have the meat and the pasta separately. Whereas obviously in this country, I think we just combine that into one big thing.
I think pasta courses are definitely a thing.
Regional differences. People might be like, you absolute swine for suggesting that. And then someone from Piedmont is like, yeah, that's exactly what we do. Do you know what I mean? Italy has an incredibly diverse food culture. It's wonderful.
Okay, second course, which may be the first course, depending on what language you're using. But it's the course that comes after starter. And it may be fish, or it may be meat, or it may be pasta. Or it may be like a little palate cleanser, might be a bit of cucumber. Anyway, Adam, what are you offering us?
So I'm offering something that I'd always been curious about and then never seen it on any of the menus. Like I'd see it on cooking shows or whatever, I'd read about it as like, this is an amazing pasta dish. I never saw it. And then there's a Sardinian restaurant in Reading that has very, very sadly just taken it off the menu. So I'm putting it onto mine. And that is a pasta called Bataga, which is... Bataga is like mullet roe that's dried into like this big block, and it is literally just pasta cooked in olive oil and I presume an unholy amount of butter, and like it's served with some like chili flakes, but mainly it just has this roe scraped over it. And Caroline and I, whenever we go to this restaurant, there would be like it wouldn't even be horse trading, because we'd know we both want that as our starter. And so it would be very much who had it last? So it's my turn. And this is the amount of it that you're entitled to share. And it's just, it's really rich. It's super flavorsome. I mean, I love seafood pasta generally, but this one is absolutely like one of my favorite things to eat. And I'm so sad that it's no longer available in Reading. So I am putting it on my menu. And similarly to what Ben was saying earlier about how well seafood goes with traditional method stuff, the seafood aspect of it, but B, just like the richness and creaminess of this dish is crying out for a traditional method cider. So Ben's already mentioned Tinston. I would definitely pair it with a cider, a traditional method from the likes of Fine and Foster or maybe Norton, who are a newer maker from Scotland. Both make phenomenal traditional method ciders. Thinking in Perry terms, Haselberger in Austria make probably the best traditional method Perry I've ever had. They've just released it. It's a blend of three Austrian varieties, Speckburner, Stiegelburner, and Landelburner. And there's also a maker in Germany called Jörg Geiger who makes a single variety Champagne Bratburner that is delicious. And again, we just cut through that richness and oiliness and seafoodiness fantastically. Mm-hmm. So that is my second course.
That sounds super nice. Hard to match up to. Justin, what have you got?
So mine is going to foreign shores. So my partner is Mexican and she has been inspiring me recently with a lot of great foods. I'd never really had authentic Mexican food beforehand. I'd always had the sort of supermarket UK pale imitation that has very little to do with Mexico at all. But this one is called Mone de Robalo. This is a sea bass tamale. So that is a banana leaf with plantain on top of it, and then sea bass, and then tomato, onion, and chili. You sort of slightly poach the sea bass, I think, and then I can't remember quite how it was made, but then you like start to fry off the onions and tomato and chili. Then you put that on top. You put it with Mexican pepper leaf, which is a kind of spice that tastes a bit like sarsaparilla. You can substitute it with fennel. It's got a kind of aniseed vibe. Then you wrap that all up in a tinfoil pack and you steam it. And it's kind of a little bit spicy, like super fresh, super bright. You've got that plantain in there to give it a little bit of that body, along with the fattiness and the deliciousness of the sea bass and all the other vegetables in it and the banana leaf. And I'm thinking, I don't know how much I back this pairing, but I was wondering about doing that with either a Thorn or a Fox Whelp, mainly on the point of the acidity. So I don't know whether the Fox Whelp would be too much for it, and it might sort of just blow it out the water with the intensity of the acid. But I was thinking, you know, related to what you were saying about the fish tacos, this is a very, you know, it's a similar, it's not the same dish, but it's the similar, it's a similar, you know, it's from the same food culture.
Yeah.
And that kind of acid-driven, fruity, bright, intense drink to go with this really fresh. And I think I was wondering with the Fox Whelp whether the plantain might kind of sort of beef it up a little bit and give it the body to harmonize with the laser-like acidity of the Fox Whelp going through this fish dish.
That was
sounds amazing.
Wonderfully described.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds awesome. And I absolutely love Mexican food. So I want to know when your partner is coming with you to cook this for the toilers.
Very, very soon. She's mentioned that she is intrigued about working at Ross.
Oh, fantastic. Mm. Fantastic. Okay, Ben, what's your final option?
So, I mean, it's yet another shameless plug. It's the meal that I cooked at the Yew Tree that we spoke about in the last episode. Wanted to speak in a little bit more detail, and actually it's really fun and pertinent that Justin's just described what he cooked so well, because this dish was actually inspired by Mexican carnitas. So in certain parts of Mexico, they will marinate pork, usually a shoulder, like on the bone, in lime juice, I believe, and then in orange juice. But orange juice in this part of Mexico, I think it's the Yucatan Peninsula, it's actually like a sour orange, what they use. So it's a little bit more akin to the lemon and lime type citrus fruit, you know, and acid. He is the acid that they use. And that acid helps to break down, you know, the pork. And, you know, we know how acid works with protein. You know, you get things like ceviche, where essentially the acid cooks the food and decontaminates it before you eat the fish. So that was the inspiration for this kind of pulled pork. And the key with carnitas is then you cook it, and then it gets cooled down, and then you refry it often in something like lard, so that you get the congealed fats that are in the pork, then get refried, and it all, like, you know, you get that lovely crisp on the outside. We didn't quite do it that way because we were cooking for lots of people, and we didn't quite have the grill space, shall we say, for that. But that was basically the inspiration behind it. So we wanted to do a Herefordian kind of spin on that, because obviously it was the cider festival, so it get marinated in cider. And some apple juice and some cider vinegar to try and sort of emulate the blend of the marinade that you would get in carnitas. And then instead of using Mexican traditional spices, again, we went more Herefordian. So we used some English mustard and we used some herbs, you know, some thyme and some rosemary. That was then served with some potatoes that also had the rosemary thyme blend on them. And then probably the thing I was most proud about actually was the red cabbage and Granny Smith apple slaw, which was made, you know, very, very fine, almost like, you know, the kind of slaw that you get when you go to a kebab shop and it's like super fine and it's just like it's almost breaking down into its own marinade, with, again, loads of cider vinegar, apple juice, I think a little bit of cider went into there. And yeah, it was supposed to be about the cider. It was supposed to be a kind of not necessarily a reimagining, but just taking inspiration from a place and then using the flavors we wanted. So we wanted to use pork, we wanted to use cider. How can we bring these together without just doing something uber fucking simple and just literally, you know, cooking pork in cider and calling that, you know, we wanted to do something with a little bit more finesse to it. Now, to be honest with you, I don't really have pairing for this, because I feel like the way it's cooked, pretty much any cider can go with it. And I know that's a bit of a cop-out, but there's just a lot of room to play. So I wanted to just discuss what kind of ciders would go well with it. So you've got that kind of pork, which is very fatty. It's got the herbs, it's got the mustard, it's got lots of kind of earthy flavors in there. So I think something that's got those tannic earthy flavors would work. Something Dabinet, Yollington Mill, even something like Brown's Now, which always that goes perfectly with pork. I think it just has such a really lovely kind of porkiness to it, almost, in the cider. But I think what I would pair with the pork specifically, because I think you want a little bit of acid for that fat, is Kingston Black. So you've still got those kind of tannic earthy flavors, but you've got a little bit of that bright fruit and a little bit of acid just to help break down that really fatty, because all of that fat falls apart into the sauce that you're cooking it in. So you just have uber amount of, like, you know how pork fat goes really sticky when you cook it? I mean, you cook sausages, it just sticks to whatever you're cooking it in. I think the Kingston Black will help break that down. Then we've got those potatoes, and if you wanted a separate pairing for those, purely for the potatoes, I think something like Major or even Harry Master's Jersey, where the fennels will play really nicely with the herbs, but the potatoes are robust enough to stand up to the tannins, and they're soft and fluffy and a little bit sweet. And then, of course, you've got that slaw, and I think basically anything with eating apples will work really well with that slaw, because you've got some in there with the Granny Smiths, but then you've also got right, kind of cabbage is a little bit earthy, you've got the cider vinegar in there. But I think if you were going to pair one cider with the whole thing, I would say, I think Kingston Black is the way to go. I hate plugging Ross Cider relentlessly on here, but I did have a very nice Kingston Black cider on draft at festival that I think is exactly what is going on in my head. And I don't drink enough cider for my shame at the moment to be able to pick another producer, but I have had some very nice Kingston Blacks. The other one I have, I think, would work, but it is a little lean and taut, is the Burrow Hill Kingston Black, but it is very dry. And I don't know if it would go quite as well, but I think the fat of the pork would work really nicely with it. So that is another option if you are towards the southwest. But yeah, something that I really enjoyed doing. And it is very much an expression of not just my favorite things to cook, but also the influences that have been upon me in terms of working in cider and working on farm and picking apples and understanding how that all comes together. I think it was a really nice way for certain people who attended to start the festival.
Yeah, no, I think that's amazing. I'm really even more furious that I didn't get to try it, because it's brilliant. And I think the way that you have taken the inspiration and woven in the flavors of Herefordshire is absolutely fantastic.
I appreciate that.
Our Kingston Black and Bulmers, normally we have embossed all the Kingston Black on draft. Yeah, it sounds right, because I think you don't need something that's too acid.
No, you just want a little bit.
Something that's got the fruit and the flavour that is going to contribute to the dish. But as you say, like, it's a really well-balanced, well-put-together dish in the first place, that it doesn't need a cider that's going to take the flavour to a different dimension, I think.
Yeah.
Is that your like main offering, or have you got something more substantial coming?
No,
or is
that is my main. So I've gone starter, yeah. Main, dessert, cheese. Yeah, exactly. I've gone very, very trad British.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The, you know, pub that thinks it's slightly better than a pub type meal. Gastro pub meal. which is exactly what I would run. I'm not being dismissive of that. That's how I would run,
yeah,
a restaurant.
Well, I mean, you know, our supper club at the pub, which is happening on the 2nd of October, is starter, main, dessert. And there ain't even any cheese. Bring your own cheese if you want.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, like, that's feasible. But this is the end of the universe, so we're going to allow Justin and Adam with their primo courses. But do you have a secundo course to, I don't even know if that's correct, to join Ben, or what would you offer as your post-fish dish?
So I am going to Eastern Europe for my next one. And I was being indecisive about what to pick, but I have picked it at last after sort of much heartache. I would make sarmale, which I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I've only ever seen it written down, but they are a type of cabbage roll. It's one of those sort of cabbage rolls that exists across Central Eastern Europe and right down into Turkey. This particular one originated in the Ottoman Empire and then branched out. This is the particularly Romanian permutation. So what that is pickled cabbage leaves stuffed with rice, onion, I think garlic, the fattiest pork mince you can get your mitts on, and shitloads of dill. And you wrap them up, and then you put them in a big pot, and you cover it with tomato juice, and then you cook it really slowly for ages, and then you serve it with sour cream. It's great. Like, very, very rich. For the first course, I went like very light and fresh, and then I went to more like acidic and sharp, and kind of those Mexican flavors, and now we're going into big sort of like heavy flavors. And I thought it was nice that you said about brown snout being a companion for pork, because I thought the brown snout, with its sort of jellied fruitiness alongside the darker flavors and the tannin in there, I thought that brown snout could be a really cool pairing for this. Particularly, you know, the lightly conditioned one springs to mind that you did, Albert, but obviously there's a constellation of brilliant brown snouts out there.
There are, but not enough, because Brown Snout is probably the greatest apple to have ever existed and be made into cider. I'm leaning towards your incredible sounding sommelier precisely because I could have it with Brown Snout, which if I was at the end of the universe, I would need to drink Brown Snout. So good that Ben also offered it as a say, well, if you want Brown Snout, you could have it with my dish. Adam, what have you got?
So, again, this one's inspired by, like, the most sort of surprising and kind of memorable food and cider slash pairing I ever had. I mentioned earlier that I'm kind of always drawn to game when it's on a menu, more out of, ooh, that's something a bit different, you know, quite, and this one particularly, like venison, I'm always like, ooh, venison, and then I forget that actually quite often it's dry or too tough or whatever, and okay, but when I was in, lucky enough to be in Austria last September, we had this kind of dinner that was paired entirely with local perries, and, you know, you bring out a, like a venison loin with like a fruity jus, and you sort of, I think quite a lot of people will go, well, you know, how on earth are you going to pair perry with that? And what they paired it with was something that Justin mentioned earlier, which is this Mostello. In their case, they paired it with the sweet Mostello. So Mostello, again, is a fortified perry. It's been aged for 4 years in casks. To make the dry version, you ferment the perry to dryness and then fortify it with pear spirit, which is kind of along the lines of how they make sherry. To make the sweet version, they do it the same way as they make port, which is that the fermentation starts and then they arrest that fermentation by the addition of spirit, bring it up to sort of 18-19%. And you sort of think, you know, sweet fortified perry is a thing with a main course sounds wild, but actually you have the sweetness and fruitiness of the jus that was with the venison, because, you know, game loves fruit, and then you match that with the depth and richness and still acidity of this fortified barrel aged long aged, I think it was a 2011 perry. So it was all that richness and complexity, and it, you know, I left thinking, wow, you know, I need to think more broadly about what works with food pairings, because I just never have expected it. I mean, at that point I didn't know that fortified perry existed. I was only aware of kind of like the pear equivalent of pomo, which is a fortified juice rather than a fortified fermented perry. And so yeah, so that's I'm picking that because that was my all-time kind of most surprising and memorable food and perry pairing. My cider option for that sort of venison, I think it's kind of been touched on without being anyone's definite option, but I mean, Oakage Yarlington Mill is just such an obvious, you know, win with venison, because it's got so much depth and juiciness, but it's got that tannic structure to really, like, dig into the, you know, to the protein of the venison without kind of overwhelming the fruitiness of it. I think it will be one of those pairings where both the cider and the food massively benefits from association.
Yeah, awesome. I really like that. Have you ever had good venison in this country, Adam?
I have. I had fantastic venison, you know, less than a year ago, which was cooked by someone who's a famous Bulgogi chef. And
Albert, you are fishing for compliments, absolutely. Every time anything is ever mentioned, like,
it was phenomenal. No,
have you ever had that somewhere?
I can't even remember what we had it with, because the venison was so good. Oh, we did have it with port, so nothing memorable. The venison was phenomenal. We had that for New Year's Eve this year. It was, yeah, definitely nipped in late to be one of the best things that I ate in 2022.
You could talk. I only brought it up because we said you don't always get grace. Anyway.
Well, and to add to what Adam said, like we discussed in the last podcast, the Harry Masters jersey 2021, that fruitiness, I think would also work really well, wouldn't it, with that dish that you described? Because it just it has that fruitiness that you don't always expect from a Harry Masters, but it still has that tannin to kind of bring things to a deeper level. So I think that's the nice thing about your pairings. Is you've got the perry, which almost is like, let's bring things lighter, and then the Yarlington Mill is like, let's take things darker, like let's get down and dirty with those gamey flavors.
Yeah, I think just both cases, they're just so fruity and rich, and that's just the key, isn't it, for
Sounds like another case for brown snout.
Yeah, I think it would go well, bro. I was just thinking when Justin, you know, kind of, oh, sorry, when Ben flipped you, I suppose you could do brown snout. You know, I don't want to kind of just throw brown snout the bone when I've elected Yarlington Mill, but brown snout would definitely work.
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, brown snout may as well be the option, and then people can choose the dish. Okay, so that was Ben. So, well, I mean, that's basically the main course, I suppose, and then. Adam and Justin, have you got a dessert, or are you flipping?
We'll let Ben go first with his dessert, because he's got his cheese course afterwards. So.
Yeah, but I just wanted to check.
I'm a cheesy boy, so.
So you want no dessert?
No dessert.
This is. I mean, if this is the end of the world and there's no pudding, Becky is not going to be happy. I'll tell you that. Okay, Ben, what is on offer for dessert?
My dessert is my favorite dessert of all time. It is also I believe the favorite dessert of a Mr. Harry Potter, treacle tart, which I've literally put in brackets in my notes here, rip, because you can never fucking find it in a supermarket anymore. It's really frustrating, and I can't be bothered to make it, but it is one of my favorite desserts. And yeah, so for the pairing with that, I've written basically anything by Nightingale was my first thought, because I think those really bright, fruity, very apple-y ciders that they make, even something as, I don't want to say simple, but you know what I mean, like a set product in their lineup, like Disco, would work really, really well, because I think those apple flavors, similar to what Adam did with his venison course, you know, you've got this really kind of rich pastry sweetness, you know, all those kind of things. The apple flavors just kind of like lifted a little bit. It's like a contrast, but in a very elevating way. But actually, I had a brainwave when I was talking to my partner, Ray, because she bought a bottle of this at the festival and it was on our chest of drawers being saved for a special occasion. And I thought, you know what, that is a potentially winning combination that's a little left field, still by Nightingale. The Songbird. So Egremont Russet, nowhere near as like, you know, acidic and fruity as some of those eating apples. But it's the key to it is it's been aged in a Chardonnay barrel. I think that butteriness of the Chardonnay would allow the soft Egremont Russet to really kind of get into the flavor, because that Chardonnay barrel is going to kind of almost mollify the butteriness and the sweetness of the treacle tart. And then you're going to get this really delicate kind of floral Egremont Russet. It's one of those that, like Justin said on one of his, he's like, I'm not so sure about this. I feel like this is one you'd have to try to know if it was good or not, because it could just be annihilated. The intensity matching is a little off. Did work. Be one of those ones where you're like, oh my fucking god, I didn't realize things could go this way when you have food and cider together. So I'm gonna stick my flag in the dirt on this one and say that I think the Songbird, with its really lovely kind of buttery Chardonnay, you know, with that lovely kind of floral fruitiness from the Egremont Russet, will help the treacle tart along. And if not, it's still a really nice cider. It's still a really nice dessert. It doesn't fucking matter.
I totally agree.
I'm actually going to jump in, because I think that I've moved away from pudding the older I get, but child to re-engage with my inner child Justin was a pudding beast. So I think I'll throw child Justin a bone, and I'm going to go extremely down the line obvious on this one, but child Justin's, one of his favorite desserts was a really, really dense sticky toffee pudding. I would stick really the sort of fresh vanilla ice cream, and then do that with an Eden ice cider.
Nice.
And just do a full, you know, there ain't no cutting through here. You're about to do eat the dark soul of a star in terms of density.
The highway to the danger zone.
Well, you know, it's the end of the world. So as Adam said, I don't need to worry about the food coma I'm going to be in after this.
Yeah, yeah.
I can have this and then the universe will cease to exist. And so will I.
But I, like Justin, am not a great pudding person. So I would normally do starter main rather than main pudding. But actually, if I am having pudding, I love, you know, it's generally going to feature chocolate. You know, the absolute ideal kind of sweet thing, as far as I'm concerned, is Well, I used to say chocolate ice cream, but I've since had chocolate sorbet in both San Sebastian and recently with you, Albert, in Tremor in Ireland, and my mind was blown. So, you know, but the problem with chocolate is that it just does not play nicely with drinks, like of any sort. And this is a thing in wine, like it is too mouth coating, it is too thick, it makes everything far bitterer, sort of seem far bitterer than it actually is. It's like there are certain things, I mean, you know, if I was having chocolate and think of a drinks pairing, I'd probably go in like a, you know, a roasty dark beer kind of direction. If I had to go with something fermented fruit, it would be like a port, but I'd going, I'm not going to love this as much as I'd love other pairings. So I've ruled out chocolate. And so I've just gone with something that A, is from my youth, and B, is kind of, you know, at least featuring some pom fruit. And I've gone with an apple strudel. Because I haven't had an apple strudel in absolutely ages, but I used to love them when I was little. So, you know, it's, you know, light enough that it can kind of play nicely with our fruit beverages. But it's got, you know, it's got all that spice. It's kind of comforting. It's lovely, you know, proper comfort food pudding. So my cider option that I kind of had last year and thought this is great, this is just perfect for having with you know, fruity desserts, but it again, it's sort of quite comforting and has some nice richness, but it's still got the acidity to cut through stuff. It was a Kingston Black that Artist Raw did that was very naturally sweet. It was cold wrecked, so it was only sort of 3 or 4% alcohol, really intensely sweet, but it had all of that like tropicality and spice that good Kingston Black has, you know, just a pure fruit bomb. And yeah, that would be perfect, I think, as a foil for apple strudel. For my pear option, I have gone with a French star. So I've gone for Domfront Poiré, probably from Jérôme Forget, because I think he's an amazing maker. And I'd go for an older vintage because Domfront Poiré ages fantastically and just gets kind of richer and juicier, and the fruit deepens the more it ages, but it still has a little bit of acidity. And the key pair to Domfront Poiré is called Plante de Blanc, and that's got this lovely kind of in youth it's like tangerine-y and floral, but it just again deepens into this kind of tropical and like dried apricot kind of direction, and I can see that being really, really delicious with an apple strudel without being too sticky and too heavy, you know, so I still sort of feel fresh at the end of my meal.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think that a lot of what you said is spot on, and Ben was touching on it, that it's really hard actually to pair cider with desserts. And even out of yours and Justin's kind of natural aversion to desserts, it making it hard to come up with the pairing. When we've been thinking stuff for the cider, for the supper club, it's like main course, no problem, right? Because you can play with any kind of big bold flavors you want that come to, you know, almost you can write them down on a checklist, and then you can find a dish or make a dish that suits them all to max with your cider. But when you're making it, it's really hard. And there's two desserts that I want to just quickly talk about, even though I'm not officially pitching for the banquet. The first one is what we served at our supper club in the spring, which me and Martin were really, really happy with in the end. We made a dark chocolate ganache tart on a ginger nut base that we served with a raspberry coulis. So we kind of had, you know, the richness of chocolate, but we were offering you ways to tone down that richness that would let the cider come in and still give you plenty of flavor, but not just be this clash where they weren't meeting. And we paired that with our Dabernet single variety that had been a rum barrel. So it kind of had a kind of additional fruitiness to it. My other pairing that I loved was a few years ago, we had a random visit from an Estonian guy that was staying in the guest house on the farm. He came along and spoke to me and Dad. And I mean, this was like 8 years ago. It was before I was working for the cider company, nearly 10 years ago, maybe. But we were bottling an oak cask major, and he gave us a box of Estonian chocolate liqueur truffles that he made for his business in Estonia. And eating those with the major was like the best chocolate and cider experience I've ever had, ever. And it was the fact that they were the with the liqueur, this extra flavor, that was kind of the bridge between the chocolate being hard to pair with cider and the cider really working. So they were great. The other one that's just come to mind is that for Christmas during COVID, my brother made truffles with cider in them. So he like made these with our Armagnac cask Dabernet and Biscay, he made chocolate truffles that were a mixture of chocolate with the cider that cooked into them. And they were absolutely outstanding. But you wouldn't need to pair a drink with them because they were so They were a lot of fun. Okay, here we go. We got a final offering, a cheese course. By the way, I'll just say that next year's steak and raisin, we'll have a different raisin paired
Jesus
with each dish.
Christ.
Wouldn't that be epic?
I should just say before you do the cheese courses that as soon as we finish the desserts and they've said, and now for the cheese course, I'm throwing myself into the void that is the end of the universe. The cherry backwards just way.
What's paired with the cheese? A pomo. Yeah, cool. Well, see you later.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay, Justin, cheeses.
Mine, very, very simple. I'm going to have a single cheese. And this is a cheese that I remember from back way back when I was at university. There was a cheese shop around the corner, and this one was called Cambridge Gum Burner, and it was a 3-year age cheddar. So it was like quite intensely aged. It was really, really sharp, very, you know, the kind of texture where it's almost pure salt crystals. You wouldn't go through it, like you couldn't cut through it smoothly. You would cut through it and it would fracture like slate. It was amazing. And I would pair that with a Flaky Bark single variety for the kind of ultimate, really intense, like creamy yet salty and sharp, paired with big sweet fruit and real aggressive tannin. Just for a, you know, it's the last meal you're ever going to eat. So why not strip the entire inside of your mouth?
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. Ben, can you beat that?
Maybe. I have three cheeses. I'll try and be really brief with them. So the first one is an aged Gouda, one of my favourite cheeses, I believe, Albert, one of your favourite cheeses as well.
I love an aged Gouda.
Meat, once it's been aged long enough, which I think works really well with the cider I paired for it, which is the Ross & Wye Ashton Brown Jersey 2015, which is included in this pairing only because I pressed all of the apples for it, so it's basically my cider. But I just think it's that age loves age thing, right? You know, the ABJ is super well aged and it's got lots and lots of complexity in there, but it wants aged meat or aged, you know, like charcuterie or even, you know, aged.
Yeah, plus that batch of ABJ was like super caramelly, which would just be amazing with
super
really
rich, super bold, the bittersweet's there, but it's really fruity if I recall. And then I believe a little touch of kind of peatiness and barreliness in there as well, which I think just works well with the age of the cheese. The other cheese I've got is, and I'm going to butcher the pronunciation on this because it looks Italian, but it's actually German, Montagnolo, which is basically like a triple cream blue cheese from Bavaria. I've only had it once and it fucking changed my life. And I think I had a pet Ross with that, but I think, and I've written here actually, I believe one of Barry's Perry's would go wonderfully with this, but I haven't had enough of them and written enough down about them to remember which one would, but I imagine they all would go wonderfully. And shout out to Barry at Curtle Writer. But I've got here actually, I've got a Borough Hill Pomo, because I think a Pomo would go really nicely at that point. You've got that fruitiness, creaminess. There's a little bit of that funky, like real richness in that cheese, but it's not full Stilton. And then the last cheese I have, shout out and to round things off, I think, in a nice way, Toby and Kate. Toby is Albert's cousin at Hancock's Meadow. They make a wonderful cave-aged ewe's milk cheese every year. It's fucking delightful. I've literally sat and watched Justin chew cheese off the rind because it's so tasty, while he's literally like, this is going to do me an injury. And actually have a good pairing, because what I suggest you do, if you ever get your hands on that cheese, they're probably selling cider at the time. Whatever cider they have available for them will be the perfect pairing, because they make the cider and the cheese in the same fucking place. And it literally, you know, to bring together everything we've discussed so far, back to what Justin said in, I think even in the first part of this episode, what grows together goes together. And the Hancock's Meadow cheese with the Hancock's Meadow cider, and they make amazing cider, by the way, some of the best ciders I've had in a long time. It'll be perfect. And such a beautiful expression of not just Herefordshire, not even just the town they live in, but a very, very small holding farm that they work on. You'll get to taste that in that cheese and in that cider. And I'd be very, very happy for that to be the last thing I eat and drink before I jump into the void with Adam. Albert, you're the host of this podcast, and I presume we have a couple of minutes left, and none of us would be here as the middle-aged, middle-class white men that we are making a podcast like everybody else if we didn't want and need the validation of others. So I think you have to pick a banquet.
We're putting it to a public vote.
Yeah, and where does your vote go? Where does your vote go?
I'm serving my own.
It's going to go in the same direction as the public vote, which is whoever said, and this will go fantastically with Ross on Y side, because all of the Twitter followers aside, a voice will go, yeah, it will. I was the first to like raison d'etre. No.
No, I simply cannot choose right now, but I will make a public vote, and we will all go for it. I mean, I would just serve my own food. I'm literally serving a supper club on the 2nd of October, which everyone should come to, and then they'll be able to experience my end of the world dinner. And it's probably bulgogi I live for, crispy vegetables on Nepali chili sauce I live for that. Apple crumble, yeah, maybe. I was thinking that banoffee pie would be a dessert that you could pair something with. Yes,
I reckon you could pair banoffee pie with. It's a pet nat carton condition banana milk.
Yeah, okay. And on freshly that note, thank you ago. Everybody. Thank you. This is the end of part two, Cider Voice Food Appreciation episode. We'll see you in a week or so. Thanks everybody.
See you next time.